On the docket, James Hubert Porter versus the Commonwealth of Virginia. Mr. Wisely, Ms. Adelphia.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May I approach?
Absolutely. Mr. Wisely, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. I'm going to reserve 7 minutes, please.
All right. My clerk will set the clock such that when 7 minutes has passed.
When 7 minutes is left.
When 7 minutes is left, well, when 8 minutes has passed, the yellow light should come on. It is your response. I will try to remind you, it is ultimately your responsibility. If we keep you talking, you need to tell us. I'd like to save it for rebuttal, but we'll try not to do that.
I embrace the burden, Your Honor.
All right.
Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is Eric Wisely. I represent Mr. Porter. Your Honor has read the briefs, but it might help the kids in the room maybe that if I go through the fact, the issue.
Well, let me help you with that because please. There's a recent case said, in fact, last week, you may or may not be aware of it, Johnson versus Commonwealth, said by our Supreme Court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Everyone knows about the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation in trials in criminal cases.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lesser known due process right to confrontation in parole and revocation proceedings. And while it's there, it's a much more relaxed standard. And in Virginia, we have two tests for whether or not confrontation right has been satisfied. And it seems to me, at least in the context of this case, we're really talking about the so-called reliability test. Would you agree?
I would, Your Honor. However, I think if we don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse in a case like this where it we need to get through the analysis at this point, I would suggest that we start with whether it's hearsay, then we move on to whether it's testimonial.
Hearsay is different analytically than confrontation.
I agree 100%, Your Honor. The hearsay is not going to be an issue.
Hearsay is generally admissible in revocation proceedings, is it not?
That's correct, Your Honor. The right of confrontation, it's a 14th Amendment right of confrontation, not a Sixth Amendment.
Exactly. Right. So, but we're not talking about the rules of evidence involving hearsay here. We're talking about...
But hearsay is an out-of-court statement by a declarant offered for the truth of the matter. And so you have to establish that hearsay element. It's got to be hearsay before you never
well,
even get into
a confrontation. We're talking about a written statement made by a witness.
That's correct.
The witness never testified, the written statement was introduced. And the question is whether that violates the due process right to confront the witness against you,
well,
essentially.
So if we're going to...
If
we're going to breeze past the testimonial issue, and I think the court should. There's absolutely no question that the written statement in this case is testimony. It was prepared by a probation officer, a law enforcement officer, within the ambit of her responsibility as supervising her probationer. She suggested in her that she learned this information through questioning and asking this out of court declarant.
Did the probation officer give any non testimonial reason for taking the statement?
The court's read the Commonwealth brief. I see a lot of surmise. I see speculation.
But you have to look at it in context of the record. And in context of the record, the probation officer was not citing him with a violation. The probation officer was trying to get him to the police station so he could register.
Well, that was her
testimony.
No, what she said was that directed him to come. This is in the appendix at around page 9, the NBR. I directed him to come to my office so that I could tell him to go to the police department.
Right.
This is all within the ambit of her job.
But
then she said through questioning in the NBR. She says through questioning, I determined that she was staying
But only in the context of trying to give directions to get to the police department.
You can say that it was in the context of that, but the case law.
Law says you look at the totality and you look at the evidence in the context of the circumstances.
That's correct, Your Honor. In every single case where a law enforcement officer, within the ambit of her investigation, while she's performing her duties, there's never been a case that I'm aware of where exigency wasn't also present. There's no exigency in this case. So, in other words, if an officer comes up on a car and he says, and somebody has a gun or somebody has evidence that's being destroyed, that's an exigent circumstance. And if somebody makes a statement like, you need to destroy that cocaine, then that would be an exigent circumstance that would yield that wouldn't be a testimonial utterance. However, I'm not aware of any case in any court where a law enforcement officer, without any exigency whatsoever, with any ambit of her responsibility, takes within an investigation that she admits is an investigation.
So what about, you're using the probation officer in the context of a law enforcement officer, and that's fine.
Which she indubitably is.
Okay, that's fine. But let's talk about a scenario where an officer approaches somebody and is giving somebody directions how to get somewhere, and they say, geez, I'm not from around here, I don't know how to do that. And the officer looks to the guy next to him and says, are you from around here? No, I'm from out of town. Where are you staying? Well, I'm staying over here. Okay. Well, so you don't know the area either, so I'm going to be more...
Well, I appreciate the hypothetical. That's not what happened here. On her own words, her own testimony, she was in the room interviewing her probationer. And she says explicitly, that... right around Appendix 20, but she says explicitly, based on my questioning, the answer she gave me, while I was interviewing my probationer, I went out in the other room to ask questions of Ms. Miranda. That's what she says in the MVR at Appendix 9. This was not a case where she was not performing her function. That was her function. She was performing her function. Within the aim of that function, there's no exigency. There's no reason. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that it's made even more plain from the record that this was part of her investigation by the fact that she made the written statement. And the written statement, I think it's extremely important that we touch on this, and if the court's going to thinks it's as indubitable as I do, then that's fine. But the written statement is the only evidence against my client. The written statement in this case was clearly designed to be offered in the place of her testimony at trial.
Let me ask you this question. For the first of my question, let's assume it's a testimonial statement, okay? So we get past that.
Well, you said it, so are you talking about the written statement?
The written statement is, for the purpose of my question, let's assume it's testimonial.
I think you should.
Have you read Johnson?
I have, John. Right. I actually filed a letter with the court under Rule 5A4A.
Yeah, I think I did see that.
Yes, you mentioned it.
So, in Johnson, the issue was that it was, of course, corroborated to some extent. And how does that apply here?
Well, I think it's a good question. Number one, in Johnson's remarkably similar to the Benjamin case that was cited on the Commonwealth's brief. It was an unpublished opinion of this court, where there's huge amounts of evidence against that probationer. And in Johnson, there was no doubt that there was going to be a violation because he had new charges. But what the court said was, when it referred to the confrontation susceptible information, it said that it actually went to the Henderson good cause analysis. It actually went to that good cause analysis, which is something that did not happen in the Henderson case itself, where the court never actually said that. So what I would suggest to the court is that Johnson is not a Henderson case. Johnson is a Cox case. In Cox, the court cited its exact reason
But in Cox, we said you can... We interpreted Henderson, whether correctly or incorrectly.
I agree, there's some issue there.
But in Cox, we interpreted Henderson as allowing us to infer that the trial judge found the statement to be reliable.
Well, I think what you said in Cox, Your Honor, and with all due respect, I don't want to step into your shoes too much, although I know Judge Humphreys did a yeoman's work in the Henderson case. The Cox case said, after laying out the law that was established in the Virginia Supreme Court in Henderson beautifully, in Cox, it said, but we don't need to get there. The trial court said what my trial court said. Hearsay is admissible in a probation violation hearing, and that's simply inaccurate without some qualification.
I don't want to get into mixing apples and oranges with you. I just have one simple question.
Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on the record on this. There's this sort of ongoing conversation between your client and the probation officer and the witness. And at the point in time where the officer asks her where she's staying, and she answers in Front Royal. Where is your client at that point?
That was not on the record, Your Honor. I would say that that evidence was not on the record.
Okay,
the closest the court can get to finding that evidence would be that she said, I talked to him in my office, and then I went out into the other room to talk to Mr. Johnson. And I think what the court might be sniffing around about is an adoptive admission on the part of my client by listening to this information being given to Ms. Moran, and not objecting when he hears her give the information to the probation officer. That's not the case here. My client was in office. She went out there to question.
Please, let me ask. Yes, Your Honor. The joint appendix, this is why I'm trying to get it clear. Maybe you can clear it up, and it is what it is.
I hope I can.
But on page 42 of the joint appendix, it appears to be...
Page number, I missed that, Your Honor.
42?
Yes, Your Honor.
Poe then instructed Porter to go to the Front Royal Police Department where they re-registered. And then Porter informed Poe he was unaware of where that was located. Poe said she would give Porter and Moran directions. Poe then asked Moran where she was from. So it strikes me that's sort of a continuous conversation. Is that an error?
When she was testifying on direct, she said just the opposite. She didn't say anything like that. I think you might be able to take that implication if that were the only evidence that were available. The evidence, if you look earlier in the appendix, she says...
What page?
I'm looking at... Hold my glasses out here. I apologize. Well, let's start with the MVR. I know it is in the appendix.
Well,
I'm sorry,
that
I don't have that. But in the MVR,
it's a simple question. If you can't answer it,
and maybe you can answer it on a rebuttal.
I will look for
it. Find it.
But Your Honor,
give it to us.
If you look in the MVR, she clearly says, "I questioned him in a room. I walked out into the lobby and questioned her based on the questions I had with him." This is part of her investigation. That's why it's testimonial. And as long as we're talking about only the written statement, because Your Honor, it is absolutely clear. The sole evidence that was admitted against my client is the written statement. No oral statements came in, and I made every objection to the circumstantial statements as well that I objected as part of my assignment of error number two. I hope that I get a chance. To me, the fact that this is both hearsay, that it is hearsay, is an out-of-court statement of a declarant offered for the truth is indubitable. And the fact that it's testimonial, the written statement can't have been anything but intended for offering at trial. There's no other reason you would make that written statement. It's essentially an affidavit saying, look, I'm not going to be able to procure your services at trial. I'm not going to be able to subpoena you because you're homeless. This is the circumstantial information I don't think should have been admitted either based on my objections. But there is no other reason to prepare that written report. None. There's no other reason to do it except to try and offer it at trial to convict my client in the absence of the person who made the representation. And so at that point, you proceed to the Henderson good cause analysis. However, I would suggest we don't ever get to the actual Henderson good cause analysis because Cox teaches that if the trial court puts out or bases its ruling on an error of law, and in this case it's exactly the same error of law, hearsay is admissible in probation violation hearings. You don't ever apply the good cause, the good cause,
I'll either let you sit down or I'll ask you my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
If we rule for you, what relief are you entitled to? Isn't it just another hearing that at the on the probation violation?
I don't know if I can talk about the vagaries of rushing in 19.2-234.1 and 19.2-306 in the next 2 minutes. But I would suggest, Your Honor, that rushing was overruled or was... But you have to remember, rushing is based on principles of constitutional principles.
It specifically was not.
It cited to Crawford v. Commonwealth. Crawford v. Commonwealth cited to constitutional principles. In footnote 5, Rushing says, yeah, we never get to the double jeopardy principle. That's correct. But it does cite to Crawford v. Commonwealth. Crawford v. Commonwealth specifically says constitutional, and it does talk about due process. What I would suggest is that the only way
Crawford
that...
Sixth Amendment confrontation.
Oh, that's correct. But what it did say was that it wasn't very clear, but it said the constitutional provisions that were protected by due process and talk about the procedural due process, the only way that a state statute is going to be able to overrule a constitutional issue...
Are you suggesting the statute's unconstitutional?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I'm suggesting that it could overrule procedural due process because all due
Can you go back to responding to Judge Russell's question? What's the result?
I believe this needs to be reversed, obviously, and then remanded. I mean, excuse me, should be dismissed. But I'm happy to have it remanded to the trial court. It needs to be reversed because
on the rushing analysis,
the rushing analysis was only overruled by 19.2-234.1, which specifically addresses convictions. It only addresses convictions. It does not address 19.2-236.
Well, that assumes that rushing applies at all because rushing involved a conviction.
Well, what it talked about, and when it cited to Crawford v. Commonwealth, not Crawford v. Washington,
Citing the case is enough to bring it within the ambit as far as...
It said the constitutional issues raised there. It said footnote 5, it talked about double jeopardy. The Lockhart case said that double jeopardy doesn't apply, but that was 5 years earlier. What I would suggest, Your Honor, is it has to be due process because it said constitutional in the Crawford case. If it's due process, 19.2-234 can go...
Your full 15 minutes is more than enough.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Catherine Adelphio on behalf of the Commonwealth. I want to be clear about what objections were actually made below. Below, the defendant, unlike Cox, he never cited Henderson. He never cited Cox.
He did cite his right to confrontation.
He did.
Clause of the 14th Amendment. Why isn't that sufficient?
Your Honor, I think that he cited the Confrontation Clause. I searched the appendix for due process, and I searched it for 14th Amendment.
I think he referred to the 14th Amendment, which, of course, is due process. So the question is whether it's close enough for government work, I guess.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. If he did, I searched. Perhaps I missed it. I didn't see in the appendix any reference to the 14th Amendment.
There was a reference to hearsay and a reference to
many references to the Confrontation Clause. Yeah. I agree with you there.
Let me just cut the chase.
Sure.
Let's assume for the purpose of my question that we have an adequate preservation of the constitutional issue, the due process constitutional issue. Given Johnson, help us understand how to apply Johnson here. What's the corroboration, if any, of this out-of-court statement that was written out?
I would note for the court that the Supreme Court of Virginia in Johnson considered hearsay evidence, all the hearsay evidence in the totality. It did consider some non-hearsay evidence, but it considered hearsay evidence in the totality in determining whether or not the hearsay evidence was reliable. This court in other cases has held that you can consider inadmissible evidence in determining whether or not evidence is admissible. So in Johnson...
If it was actually admitted, that's true.
I would suggest to the court that certainly the circuit court was considering the verbal statements of Ms. Poe relating the verbal statements of Ms. Morin in determining whether or not to admit the written statement. I think that counsel's conceded that. He argued in his reply.
Is your argument that it's corroborated by more out-of-court hearsay?
But the Johnson court...
By the same individual?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we have basically a due process confrontation violation that negates another due process, so like it's a double negative kind of thing? Is that the analysis we're going to apply here?
No, Your Honor. I'm suggesting that a circuit court can consider hearsay evidence related by a in-court witness and consider all of the evidence related in determining whether or not portions of that evidence is reliable. And if it's reliable, then it is admissible.
Do you
agree that the circuit court didn't do what Henderson said it's supposed to do? Specifically state that he found it reliable or what have you. The circuit court didn't do that.
I agree, Your Honor, and I don't think that it was fairly put to the court that it needed to do that. You don't
read Henderson as an instruction to circuit courts that it should say that?
I'm suggesting, no, that counsel did not argue to the circuit court that it needed to conduct a good cause analysis pursuant to Henderson.
I'm talking about what the Henderson court instructed circuit courts to do.
Yes, Your Honor. Henderson instructs circuit courts that they ought to conduct a reliability or balancing test to determine...
Do you agree that the circuit court gave a reason for why it was admitting it, that all hearsay is admissible? That is wrong.
That is... I think that was a fair response to counsel's argument that...
I didn't ask you whether it was a fair response.
That's what the circuit court said.
Whose burden is it to get the correct ruling from the circuit court in this kind of a case in light of Henderson?
Your Honor, I think that the court...
Is it the person who... Let me try it this way. Is it the person who is trying to get the evidence admitted that is responsible to get the judge to make the good cause analysis, or is it the person who's objecting to the admission?
I think that they have to alert the court that...
Who's they?
The person challenging... I'm sorry, this is so loud.
That's okay.
The person challenging the evidence.
And on what authority? Case law?
I'd say Rule 5A18.
But do they need to do any more than just say, objection, this violates, the admission of this evidence violates my client's due process, you know, rights?
I think that...
Isn't that specific enough?
I would say, Your Honor, that is...
You have no case that says I actually have to cite the case by name if I get the rule of
law
right.
Well, I'd suggest that in Cox, the court found that because the court specifically cited the defendants, the challenger of the hearsay evidence, citation of Henderson in noting that it was appropriate now to...
It sounds like the Attorney General has a highly technical defense here to what's going on, but let's see if we can get past that. We have this written statement essentially that says she's staying with this guy and that violates his probation, okay? Assuming, again, that that's testimonial and that it's governed by the due process right to confrontation applies to that, how is it not error? I mean, given, and especially given Johnson, where's the corroboration of that statement that under Johnson would suggest that there's no error here in admitting it?
Well, Your Honor, I'd note that Henderson provides a number of guarantees of trustworthiness. Those include, the Henderson court says that a detailed police report has substantial guarantees of trustworthiness. It says that when a defendant fails to challenge a hearsay evidence, that also can constitute a substantial guarantee of trustworthiness.
That's why I asked, if he's standing right next to her when the probation officer says, so where are you staying? And by the way, write out the statement. If he's standing right there and doesn't speak up, then you know the suggestion is that's a sort of an admission by silence, which would, you know, it seems to be at least arguably tend to corroborate it. But is the record clear that that's what occurred?
I think that information came out during the sentencing hearing. I don't know that it necessarily came out during the... For the sentencing for the probation violation. So it came out after, and I think it was cited by the Commonwealth.
So it didn't come out during the actual taking of evidence for the guilt.
I think that's fair, Your Honor. I would suggest, though, that he knew what the violation alleged was, and he could have presented that evidence at the probation violation.
Well, but what is his obligation to present any evidence?
Your Honor, if you have evidence that is uniquely available to you and you fail to present it, a circuit court can consider that failure.
That's not uniquely available to him.
The probation officer was there.
Well, I think hypothetically, if you say, I have alibi evidence and you don't present it, the court can consider whether or not that alibi, your failure to present that alibi evidence. He knows what evidence, what the statements that we're going to be used against him.
My question, though, is what corroborates that statement? Now, if it's not clear that he was there, then what else can the Commonwealth rely on to make that statement inherently reliable?
The non-testimonial statement of Ms. Morin that she was staying with...
She's the same witness that can't be confronted about the written statement she made, isn't she?
That's true, Your Honor, but I think...
How do you support... A lack of confrontation by a lack of confrontation.
Henderson suggests that detailed written police reports...
But it seems to me arguing that this is the equivalent of a detailed police report creates a problem with another argument you've raised that it's non-testimonial.
I think it's even better than a detailed police report because he had the opportunity to cross-examine the investigator who determined that her statements were credible.
Well, let me ask you that. The reason that a detailed police report seems to me is given this badge of credibility in the federal cases that Henderson cites is that the officer knows that he's writing down stuff he's going to be asked to testify about later, and that's the whole purpose of having the detailed police report. That sure makes, and therefore any statements he's taken are essentially de facto testimonial. If you're going to put this in the same category as a detailed police report, don't you have to concede it's also testimonial?
No, Your Honor, because
What's the other purpose? What is her other purpose in taking the written statement?
I think I can see down in brief. The written statement is testimonial. Her Morin's verbal statement that was offered spontaneously that she was staying with the defendant was non-testimonial.
But that's what you're trying to compare with a police report?
I'm comparing Poe's relation of that statement to a police report.
You said she offered the statement spontaneously. I thought she answered it in response to a question, which is definitionally the opposite of spontaneously.
But it was not responsive to the question asked. The question asked was, where are you from here? And she answered, I'm staying with him. There was no indication, there was no reason for Ms. Morin to think that it was going to be, that information was going to be used against the defendant in a later prosecution. At the time, they were just trying to get him to the police station so that he could register as a sex offender.
Okay, we've gotten you a little off task. Would you go back to Judge Humphrey's original question on Johnson and the corroborating evidence? Tell us everything you've got that corroborates the written statement.
I would emphasize that Johnson considered hearsay evidence that is not admissible on its own to determine whether or not the hearsay evidence was reliable and therefore admissible.
The evidence of the same character?
It was screenshots of the girls and Johnson alleged that they had spoken with the defendant, Johnson, and they gave to the police officer screenshots that was allegedly their conversation with Johnson. And there was that evidence matched up with their oral statements, verbal statements to the officer, and the officer also asked for a written statement. There was additional evidence. The officer confirmed that Johnson lived in the area.
Worked at the Dollar General.
But I'd say in this case, but those were all also verbal statements conveyed to the officer. The officer knew that the defendant worked at Dollar General because the defendant told her that he worked at Dollar General.
A defendant's out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted is not hearsay. It's an admission.
I will tell the court. I just want to clarify one thing about Johnson, and then I want to answer. Just because I think that it was a little bit confusing during counsel's oral argument. Johnson was about whether or not the defendant was prejudiced during sentencing, not whether a violation occurred, but whether the fact that he had communicated with these girls affected his sentencing. So that is why we engaged in a merits analysis of it. In Johnson, the question was not whether or not a violation occurred. The question was, for purposes of finding a violation, the question in Johnson was, did the admission of this evidence with respect to the contact with the girls, did that affect his sentence?
Would you concede that there was significantly more corroborative evidence in Johnson than there is here?
Your Honor, I don't think so. I think in this case, he shows up with a woman at the meeting, and I think that, so like in Johnson, we have a woman in the same place, the declarant in the same place, clearly with him, they show up.
You could say the same thing about Judge Decker and I, but we don't reside together.
That's fair, Your Honor. I think that that is corroborative evidence to support her both written and oral verbal statements that she was staying with the defendant. If she's here with it, this isn't a third party saying she's staying with him. This is her state saying, I've been staying with him. And she offered it. At the time she offered it, it was not clear that was going to be used in a prosecution.
Is a merits analysis here from the perspective of the Commonwealth, am I oversimplifying by suggesting it simply boils down to the written statement is corroborated by the non-responsive answer to the oral statement that was made as a non-responsive answer to the question of where you're from. That in effect, the answer, the non-responsive answer, I'm staying with him, then corroborates the written statement, and that's enough under Johnson? Is that the Commonwealth's position?
I think so, and the fact that she was there with him and she showed up with him.
But how does that corroborate the statement?
I think it's one more indicia of reliability, because it shows that if she wasn't there, it shows that they know each other, at least. This isn't a random person who says, I've been staying with the defendant.
It's not a probation violation to know somebody, and you know, if the probation violation here is if he's violating terms of probation by having her stay with him.
I'll tell the court that in Johnson, the Supreme Court of Virginia was concerned that perhaps the girls had been confused about whom they were speaking with, and one of the things that they considered in determining that, in fact, they were speaking with Johnson was the fact that Johnson lived in the area. And he had the opportunity to actually come in contact with these girls. Similarly, Ms. Morin clearly had the opportunity to stay with the defendant. She was traveling with him, and she offered she made a non-testimonial statement to Ms. Morin, my argument on brief was very inartful, but I would note that when the defendant objected to the non-testimonial statement that Ms. Morin was staying with the defendant, the court did not sustain that objection. And that failure to get a ruling means that the statement was admitted at trial. And unless the court has any other questions, I'd ask.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to point out that time has expired, but if you have a question.
I was just going to ask the same question we asked your opposing counsel. If we were to reverse, what would the proper remedy be?
It is a probation revocation hearing, Your Honor. It cannot be reversed and dismissed. As the court pointed out, rushing deals with convictions. If we're going to parse between convictions and probation violations, I'd also note that Lockhart versus Nelson, the United States Supreme Court case, stands for the proposition that a court considers all evidence inadmissible and admissible in determining whether or not the sufficiency of the evidence.
Is the Attorney General's position that rushing at this point is a complete nullity given the action by the General?
That as well, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
A 1 minute, Miss.
You can have 30 seconds because we gave her 30 seconds more than she was supposed to have.
Judge Decker asked me specifically for an appendix site. That citation is page 32 from top to bottom. It says she talked with him in her office and walked out to talk to her. He talked to him in the office, walked out to talk to her. That's both top and bottom of appendix page 32. If the court disagrees with me what happens after reversal, I hope at least the court will reverse it. I'm happy with the remand. I want to make that clear for the court. Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel.